A 2024 Gallup study states only 30% of employees are engaged at their work, and 50% of all employees are actively out there looking for new jobs. Those are crazy numbers. A poor company culture is a leading indicator for disengagement and high attrition rates across the board for companies. So what's the secret to building a healthy, thriving, and even award-winning culture? Well, our guest today has done exactly that. Joining me in today's episode is Dan Turner. He's president and CEO of Experigo, a global leader in mobility and customer experience solutions for top automotive brands across the world. Since Dan took over as CEO, Experigo has won Canada's Most Admired Corporate Culture Award 3 consecutive times. In our conversation today, Dan shares his top takeaways and how his team has been able to build such an outstanding culture. He says it starts with developing a people-first culture, one where employees feel empowered to take ownership of the work that they do. We also discuss how important and powerful transparency is in communication. And then we get into things like how celebrating wins, big and small, for your team members, and just being grateful for having them really inspires them and takes them to another level, and they want to do more. We don't just talk about today, you know, the amazing culture Dan's built. If you're looking to develop a culture where employees are engaged and look forward to coming into work, or you love to hear stories about people who have moonshot dreams and were able to realize them, you're not going to want to miss this episode with Dan. I'm Damon Lemby, the CEO of LearnIt, a live learning platform that has upskilled over 2 million people over the past 3 decades. And you're listening to the Learn It All podcast, the podcast where great leaders aren't born or made, they're constantly in the making. So let's dive into this great conversation with Dan Turner. Dan, welcome to the show, buddy.
Thank you very much, Damon. Glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. So Dan, you went from being a tow truck driver to ultimately becoming a CEO. Now, this didn't happen overnight, but you knew from the minute you stepped behind the wheel of a tow truck that your goal was eventually to become a CEO. How did you know that? How did you make it happen?
Yeah, well, I would say that it didn't happen immediately. I think what happened was, you know, I finished high school not really knowing what I wanted to do with my life. And that's a tough question to ask a 17 or an 18 year old kid. And so I decided that I would maybe go out and work for a little while and figure it out. And, you know, I started driving tow truck, a job that I really enjoyed. It was working for the Canadian Automobile Association, helping members. They were always very appreciative of the help that they were receiving. But, you know, I realized a couple of years in that this wasn't going to fulfill me for very long. That I knew that I had more to bring to the table as it related to from a career perspective. And so I set that goal very early for myself. And really where the goal came from is I was reading an article in a CAA magazine about the appointment of the new AAA president and CEO. And it was a gentleman by the name of Robert Darbonnet, who has since retired. But he was being appointed the new CEO. And I read it, when I read his story, he had started off as an 18-year-old tow truck driver himself. And I remember that just resonated with me so loudly that just because this is where you start doesn't mean that that's what you have to be relegated to. And so I set the goal at that point that, you know, if he can do it, why not me? And set that goal to become a CEO at some point in my life. Now, as you said, that didn't happen overnight. It was, you know, 30 plus years to achieve it. But, you know, it really was, it gave me that kind of North Star to always head towards, regardless of whether, you know, in the times where, you know, you make great progress in your career to the times where, you know, maybe you felt that your career wasn't progressing at the pace that you would like. But it kept me grounded in, you know, where I was trying to take this. And, you know, I'm a big believer that whatever you put your mind to, you can achieve. And, you know, it's been a great motivational story to share, not only with, you know, lots of different people, but with my kids particularly. Whenever life kind of beats them down a little bit, I just remind them of my story that anything's possible, guys. So set the goal and go get it.
Yeah, I'm thinking about our listeners out there, and they're like, okay, fantastic. This guy, truck driver to CEO. That's a massive goal. You've had to have stepping stones along the way, right?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I learned very early on, that when you're looking at a goal that seems almost impossible to achieve, and, you know, when you're sitting there as a 21-year-old tow truck driver becoming the CEO of a company, and again, you know, no MBA, no university degree, it seems like a monumental task and really daunting. So I realized that, you know, if I'm going to achieve this, I've got to break this into smaller chunks. And this has been something that I've followed throughout my career now, and I recommend to other people, which is really, you know, have the big, I always call it a BHAG, right? A big, hairy, audacious goal. Have that. Have a goal so big, it scares you. But then break it into the chunks that you need to, make it more palpable. So that's what I started doing. So what's the first thing? Well, I need to be good at business. So I took some business courses to just, get the foundations of that business knowledge. I knew that I'd have to be good at public speaking and being able to speak in front of people. So I took courses at night on how to be a public speaker. I took advantage of every kind of, educational opportunity that I could while holding down a job. And then at one point, the real, kind of turning point for me in that journey was, I realized, and this is going to date me, but I realized that, you're going to have to figure out how to use a computer because they were a new tool in the office that I had no understanding of. And, this is a story that my wife still, sweats when she hears, but I went out and I bought a compact Presario, if you remember those. It was a $3,000 computer, of which, in today's dollars, it's probably like $15,000. And we had no money at the time and two young kids. And my wife lost, she lost her cool when she came home and saw this, new thing that I had purchased. But it was really a turning point because I sat there every night, here I was in the furnace room of my house on a little card table, teaching myself on a bunch of CD-ROMs on how to use applications. And when the first big promotion, came my way as far as an opportunity, the advantage that I held over other people is that I knew how to use a computer. And I was able to demonstrate that and how I would use that in this new role and got my first promotion out of the truck into the office. And it's those kind of bold moves that I've learned to make. And so, yeah, setting all those little goals along the way and then achieving them and being able to, provide yourself with some recognition that you have achieved, a piece of your goal, because when a goal is 30 years in the future, you need to have that reinforcement that you're making progress. And so, Damon, that's what I did. I set all these little goals along the way, celebrate them as I went. And then always look at what is the next thing that I need to do to propel my career just that little bit further. And, as I said, it was a 30-year journey, maybe 45 goals from start to finish or more. But that was how I approached it. And it just always felt like I was making progress, even when sometimes maybe the progress wasn't as quick as I wanted. But to me, I think everybody needs to look at not just their career, but life in general that way. Don't look at the end game. I mean, you have the end game in mind, but look at what you need to do tomorrow to take that first step towards it.
So going back to purchasing that computer, $3,000, that's a lot of money. What were you anticipating your wife was going to say when she first saw it?
I pretty much anticipated exactly the way it went down. it was, and here's the kicker, Damon, is that I borrowed every nickel to be able to buy that computer. She was upset initially because, as I said, we didn't have a lot of money. Now we have this payment on a computer that she didn't quite understand why we needed it. But, in our marriage, it's always been a partnership, and she knows, she's always known that I'm ambitious and that I don't, I take things seriously and I plan things out properly. And so I think once she had a chance to kind of just absorb what had just taken place, I pretty much never heard about it after that. Obviously now, she likes to tell that story herself, because it really was a turning point in where my career went from there. And, I like to tell her, I told you so, but that's not a good thing to do in a marriage. So, I expected her to be upset. But I knew that it was going to be the thing that would help propel my career.
And how did you have the confidence to make such a bold, risky decision? And it sounds like I'm not just talking about, buying a computer, but in order to get from where you were to where you are now, you've had to take a lot of risks.
Yeah, I think, I've always, kind of always been a believer that without the big risk, there's never a big reward. And I think the risks you take, or I should say the size of the risk you take is always, directly related to the size of the reward that will be provided. But the confidence for me, I guess I've always been a little bit cocky. My family will tell you that most likely. But there, to me, I think there's a fine line between, you know, cocky being a negative thing, but, you know, having an abundance of confidence, which is the way that I like to describe it. And a lot of that came from my early days, you know, as a youngster. As I grew up and, you know, kind of filled out as a person, I was a small child, but around the age of grade 7, I became, you know, a pretty big guy. And that allowed me to be pretty good at a lot of sports. And that's where the confidence came from. I think sports is something that too many people are, you know, it's underrated in families, because sports gave me so many different values in my life, as far as, you know, and almost all of them are transferable to business for sure. But, you know, the confidence thing was probably the most significant, is that going in and being able to compete, as, you know, either as an individual trying to, you know, to make a team, or competing in an individual sport, or even in competing in a team sport, is, you know, going into a competition and having the confidence that you're going to be able to win, I think is required to be a winner. You know, I don't know many winners who expected to lose. So to me, that's where it came from. And even today, I mean, I'm still a big believer that if you're optimistic, if you're positive, if you have confidence, if you visualize yourself winning, whatever winning means to you, that you'll find a way to make it happen. And that's just been something that I've carried through from my early days on, you know, on my high school football team to even sports as I became an adult. I always go back to kind of that sports upbringing that allowed me to, you know, use a lot of that confidence and a lot of those attributes and bring it to the business world. And it's worked well for me. And I think, you know, you see that with a lot of different athletes and people that have been involved in sports. They you know, you look at the Michael Jordans of the world. And if you've ever watched his documentary, I mean, that guy was all about confidence and all about never settling for anything less than he wanted to achieve. You know, that's a documentary I made my daughters watch, just because I think there's just, and they were actually inspired by it. And, you know, that's the extreme, obviously, Michael Jordan, but I think it's applicable to everybody.
Yeah. And not everybody knows this, but Michael Jordan was cut from his high school basketball team.
Yeah.
Going back to talking about being overconfident, I think confidence is very important. And there's a difference between being cocky, I think, and arrogant, because I could just tell from speaking with you that you're not somebody who shows up as a know-it-all, like you have it all figured out, right? You've always taken classes, you've always learned, you've always been open to learning and getting better. But it's critical to have self-confidence. And I think a lot of individuals don't. Do you have any advice for individuals who struggle with self-doubt or imposter syndrome?
Yeah, the advice that I would give to people, if you struggle with, you know, having confidence, and, you know, we talked about this earlier, Damon, you need to step outside of your comfort zone. So many people will say to themselves that I don't have the confidence to do that, or I'm not able to do that, but then they never try. And what I have found, you know, and again, I'll as a family man, I've had these same kind of conversations with my children, which is, you won't know whether you're able to do it until you try it. And, you know, 99% of the time is that once you try it and you give it 110% effort, you will succeed. And then you start to get that glimmer of confidence. And then the next thing comes along and you got a little more belief in yourself, and you're willing to step outside of that comfort zone and give it another good try. And I think that's the real key here, right? Is, I always say that you don't fail if you don't give up, right? I mean, as long as you're persistent and keep going at it, then you haven't failed. The minute you give up on whatever your goal might be, now you failed, right? The giving up is where failure kicks in. And so that's what I always say. Keep trying. Keep putting yourself out there. Keep stepping outside of your comfort zone. And you will find that you'll be more successful than the times that you won't. And that builds confidence.
You don't fail unless you give up, right? And again, I think it comes down to, a lot of times people, they don't have the courage to try things because they're afraid maybe that they'll be made fun of or somebody will laugh at them. At the end of the day, Dan, who cares, right? Whether you succeed or fail, what I like to tell a lot of younger people that I mentor, and this goes back to myself even, is give yourself a pat on the back for trying, because there's a lot of people out there who won't even stick their neck out there and try. So I love what you say there. And I also love how you said that if you're too comfortable, then you got to get yourself out of your comfort zone.
Yeah, I think the trying itself is the success, right? I mean, that to me, whenever you can convince somebody to try something that has, you know, either scared the pants off of them or they're worried about what people will say about them, then, you know, that's failure. Once you try, even if it doesn't go as good as it you were anticipating, then at least to me, that's a success. And that's the, you know, that's the message that I send. You know, I mentor some young folks too, and that's the message that I've delivered to them, which is just get out there and try, and you will realize that you have more to offer than you think. I find a lot of people, you know, in the mentoring that I've done, you know, individuals will step forward and they don't look at some of the great things that they're able to do as being great things. And, you know, I have to point it out to them to say, look at the things that you've accomplished. You know, a 25-year-old young man, and I'm saying, look on your resume, look at these things that you've accomplished. These are great things. And he didn't look at it that way. And I said, you need to start being proud of these things. You need to start being confident about these things and even a little cocky about them. And if you can get around to that mindset that, hey, I do have a lot to offer here. There's no reason why I can't succeed. The biggest one of all that I hate to hear is when people worry about what someone else will think. Cause I believe like you, Damon, who cares? All we care about is trying to become a better person every day. And the only way that you do that is you got to keep stepping outside of that comfort zone, regardless of what people around you might say, regardless of whether you feel that you failed or not, because even something that you might perceive as a failure, and I've come across this many times in my life, you might perceive it at the time as a failure, but you know, a little way down the road, you realize that it taught you something that you needed to learn, and that new learning allowed you to succeed. So to me, you've just got to kind of keep stepping outside of the comfort zone, keep collecting those experiences, keep building on that, and it's going to lead you into a direction of success and where you want to go.
I like to say a lot of times, it's important to get yourself comfortable with failure. And failure, like you just mentioned, is really where you get a lot of the best learning opportunities to come from. Can you share an example from your professional career of a situation where you failed, but you learned and it helped you evolve in your career?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of them. I got to think of a good one though, but I can tell you that, you know, I stepped outside of the comfort zone that I was in at the time, which was I was in a career position where I was managing client accounts. And what I decided to do is that I really thought that I had some potential talent, or, you know, and even maybe overconfident about that talent in being able to be, you know, a business development executive or a business development leader. And so I left the job that I was in and took a job that I probably wasn't quite ready for. And, you know, so I got into that job and realized there's a lot more to business development that I wasn't aware of. You know, the constant rejection, the ongoing grind that you have to do when you're trying to establish a pipeline. And, you know, that was a lesson to me that, you know, you need to kind of walk a little ways and, you know, get some experiences that are in alignment with what you're trying to achieve. And I didn't do well in that first job, but I realized, you know, what I was missing, went out after that and started building some of those skills and eventually made my way back into that area and had great success. So that's one example. Another quick example was I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. And I started my own marketing company many years ago. And, you know, it was one of those things where I'm really creative. You know, I know that I can do some of these things. So let's start this business. And I was really excited because it was something that I always wanted to do. And it was 2.5 years that I did that. And it was a big failure. A failure from the standpoint of it was very difficult for me to support my family. You know, the household budget was not where we wanted it to be. We had to make a bunch of concessions as a family as far as, you know, being able to spend money. And it was not a fun couple years of our life. But there's a couple things it taught me. One was I don't ever need to be an entrepreneur to be satisfied. I thought that the only way that I would be happy is if I was running my own company. And I found out, you know, very near in the future after that, that wasn't true, because here I am today. I feel very much like an entrepreneur in the role that I'm in as a president and CEO of Experigo. But it also taught me that, you know, sometimes you think the grass is greener, you know, across the street, and many times it's not. And so, you know, look for the things to be grateful for in what you have today. And realize that not everything that you think is going to be exactly the way that you anticipate it to be. So, and those were early on in my career. You know, I was in my probably early 30s when those, both of those things took place. So, you know, it taught me a good lesson to know what to look for, to know how to approach it, and to know how to be very grateful for what you already have.
So three things you said right there that I really want our listeners to pay attention to. Number one, grass isn't always greener on the other side. Number two, things don't always go as planned. And number three, how important it is to be grateful for what you do have. Those are three key things I think that all of us need to pay attention to. And prior to coming to Experigo, you had a really successful sales career. From the research I did, I think you sold close to $500 million worth of products over the years. And you got a great story with Apple. I mean, I have one at Learn It where we landed a Gap account, you know, 25 years ago, got creative, thought out of the box, did some unique things. But my story, let's be honest, kind of fails in comparison to your Apple story. Can you share your Apple story?
Certainly. Yeah, it was you know, again, you talk about, you know, the turning point in your career. This was kind of another one, I think. Maybe not a turning point, but a propulsion point. Let's call it that. I was an account manager, or maybe an account director at that point, managing a large portfolio business for Apple Computers. We were doing tech support on you know, their computers, and I had really started to, you know, as an account person, really trying to clue into what's going on in my client's world. And with a big public company like Apple, there's a lot of information out there, but usually it's only information that Apple wants you to know. And so I started diving kind of underneath the you know, there was a bunch of different Apple fan sites. I mean, there's some people that are really passionate, especially, you know, back then when Apple was more of a niche product for graphic designers. I mean, it's obviously more mainstream now. But there were all of these different Apple user groups. And so I started to join these groups and just listen to the dialogue that was going on so I could get a feel for what customers were saying about Apple and looking for, you know, information that would help me with you know, creating a stronger relationship with Apple. And, you know, one of the things that I came across was that somebody had mentioned that maybe Apple was going to get into the cell phone business. Now, remember, this is back in 2006 or 7, that Apple was going to get into the cell phone business. Now, everybody thought that that was ridiculous, that why would they do that? And as I kept paying attention to the feed, there was an individual in this forum who produced an actual purchase order from a company in Malaysia where, you know, in this purchase order were all of these parts that were cell phone related. And I remember thinking at the time, well, you know, that's, maybe it's a little far-fetched, but there's actually evidence there in front of me. So I actually went to my boss at the time and I said, I may have stumbled across something that Apple might get into the cell phone business. And he thought I was crazy. And I had requested to go to every year in January.
You're like a spy.
Yeah, exactly. And every year they had a developers conference. I think they still do it in San Francisco every January. And I said to my boss, let me go down there and let me see if this is what the case is. And if so, I'll go there with an unsolicited proposal in my hand on how we could help them support it. He said, come on, Turner, you're crazy. You just want a free trip to California. And I said, yeah, that's true. But I think there's, you know, this is more than a hunch. And once again, I mean, he turned me down flat and there was a lot of, you know, I was persistent. And, you know, so this gets back to being persistent and trying to make a bold move, right? This was a bold move. This was putting my butt on the line a little bit. And eventually, after, you know, bugging him constantly, he said, all right, go. So I went down there to San Francisco for the developers conference. I was actually in the audience in the auditorium the day that Steve Jobs announced to sell the new iPhone to the world. So to be there for that iconic moment, first of all, was, you know, so rewarding for me. I mean, I didn't realize at the time what it would mean, but looking back, I mean, how cool was that, right? And so, you know, I was 30 rows away from Steve Jobs when he started showing everybody the iPhone. So my hunch was right. So now I was excited. I did have in my possession, you know, a 25-page document of how we would support a cell phone for Apple. Now, none of my Apple contacts were there at the conference because Apple employees are not allowed to attend that conference. So I had to drive 2 hours up to Sacramento, and I had a dinner scheduled with one of the main folks at Apple. And at dinner, I plunked my proposal down on the table. And she said, "What's this?" I said, "This is my company's proposal of how we'll help you support your new iPhone." She said, "Dan, Apple is super secretive. How did you know about this?" And I said, I have my ways. I keep close tabs on all my important clients." They were so impressed. It was, you know, dinner that day was one of the best dinners I've ever had with a client, because they were so impressed with the level of, you know, kind of just information that I had available to me, and that I was able to, you know, bring this to them so soon. And what it resulted in is that, you know, by the time they got around to launching Apple, which was just a couple months later, they awarded me and my company a huge contract to support that business based on that proposal that we did not have to go to RFP for like all the other companies had to. So everybody else that was involved in supporting Apple for that iPhone, customer care, they had to go through the RFP process and be selected by Apple. We were given the business because of my proactive approach that day. So, you know, it all paid off. It was a bold move, all paid off in the end. Big contract that I was able to secure for my company. And that was really the thing that helped propel me into a, you know, a long career in sales. And probably the biggest feather in my cap to this day.
Listeners, I want you to think back, think to yourself, if you're in sales, when was the last time that you did something creative? Because I think, Dan, now in today's environment, sales is tougher than ever. So you have to think differently. You have to do differently. But one question I have for you is, did you write the 25-page proposal yourself?
I wrote most of it. I obviously had some input from members of my team as far as, you know, putting pricing together and coming up with, you know, the various operational things that we would do to help support a cell phone, because believe you, you know, I was no cell phone expert at that point and what that would mean. But we were a big company that managed customer experiences on behalf of clients similar to Apple. And I was, you know, I'd been managing the Apple account for maybe a year, year and a half at that point. So very familiar with Apple, and I knew what would be important to them. So yeah, with the help of some of my team members, we were able to put together this proposal that spoke to all the, you know, all the important things. And, you know, what I can tell you is it led to one of the most craziest launches that I've ever seen a company launch. We had 400 agents go live on the day that the iPhone, you know, when the Apple stores opened up their door for the iPhone that day. And if you remember back, it was chaos. Here's where the chaos really kicked in for us, is that Apple, being as secretive company as they are, they would not allow us to have the information that we needed to support the iPhone until 4 hours before the official launch. So we were really scrambling in the last 4 hours before we went live in educating our own team members on what this product was and how we can help support it. And if you've ever been in that kind of business, it's absolute just bedlam. And then, of course, as soon as the iPhone launched and people marched into the stores to buy them, and then now we're looking to activate them all, then chaos ensued even further from there. But some of the most exciting times of my career really, kind of set the stage for, the learning that I had going through that entire process. Everything from, you know, going down to California and being in the room that day and presenting that proposal, and then being a key integral part of the team that launched it, there's learnings there that I carried with me into the future part of my career and even today. So it was as I said, I look back on that as being a key point in my career.
I want to get into the culture at Experigo in a second, but what did it feel like when you won that deal?
Look, for a sales guy, and you know, there's nothing better than the day the client awards you a big contract. And I've had the pleasure of being able to do that many times in my career. And yeah, that's a big day. I mean, I celebrate those moments with, you know, the entire team. I celebrate those moments with my family, because, you know, you really have to celebrate the times when you get those big wins, because you spend months not winning. It can wear on you. And, you know, as I said, as a sales guy, you hear no a lot of times, or I'm not interested, or, call me next month. I mean, and that's something that you have to grow some thick skin to be able to deal with that week after week or month after month. And but when those big ones come through, it's elation that I can't describe. And you know, the funny part is you're a hero for a day. The very next day, my boss is asking me, "What's next?
Get back on the phones."
Right.
Yeah. No, it's so true. It's so true. You got to celebrate those wins. You got to also make it about your team who helped contribute for it.
For sure.
Now, speaking of wins, at Experigo, you've won the Canadian Culture of the Year, Corporate Culture of the Year award 3 consecutive times, which is incredible. How would you describe what the culture is like at Experigo?
Yeah, describing it's always difficult because, you know, the one word that I'll use is positive. And that means so many different things, right? Is a positive environment is one where people enjoy being at work, where people are supported and don't feel like, I mean, a lot of companies that I worked in kind of had to watch your back, people willing to throw you under the bus at any moment to propel their own career. We try to eliminate all of that. So, you know, the one thing that I remember in some of the jobs that I had that I wasn't too keen about was Sunday nights sitting at home with my family, and you get that, you know, that dull ache in the pit of your stomach because you got to go into work Monday morning, and you actually, you know, despise having to go into work. That's a feeling that I don't want anybody to have at Experigo. I mean, they don't need to be, you know, elated that they're going into work in the morning, but I want them to not feel that terrible feeling. So it's all about how we, you know, some of the attributes that I would, you know, attach to our culture are open, transparent, you know, effective communication, empowerment. I think that's probably the biggest one that I've learned through the last 4 years of this pandemic is the thing that people are really looking for is treat me like an adult. Recognize that I'm good at what I do and you can give me the independence to do it and support me in that. And so those are kind of some of the key things that I would say that our culture is all about is creating an environment where you can come to work and be yourself, where you come to work and you enjoy being there with your other coworkers, where we support each other in revel in other people's success. What I always say to the team is, you know, we succeed together and we lose together. So if there's ever, you know, a failure that we have as an organization, that's a failure that we'll share and we'll learn from and we'll move forward. But when the win comes, we're gonna all celebrate the victory as well. So it's really about, you know, I'll go back to sports again, Damon. I realized that, and this is, you know, kind of where it came from is when I first joined the organization and we didn't have the culture that we have today, what I noticed is that the business was very much in silos. And when there was a failure, it was one department pointing at the other department to blame them for the failure. And I remember reflecting on that and thinking, how come when I played on some of these really competitive baseball teams that I used to play on back in the day, how come that never happened with that team? When we lost the championship game and I should have been the, you know, the person that was responsible for the loss in the way that it, you know, this story, Damon, was we were in a championship game. They asked me to play left field, which I'm an infielder. I never played left field, but they wanted my bat in the lineup. I know you're a baseball guy. In one of the last innings, a ball was hit over my head that allowed them, you know, the 3 runs scored and we lost the game. Now, when I got back to the bench that game, why did nobody, you know, kind of center me out as Dan's the reason we lost. And so that was what I was reflecting on. And I thought, you know, the reason why is because in the first 7 innings of that game, there were plenty of opportunities to win the game. We had bases loaded and another guy struck out. We had so many opportunities and there were other errors in the game that cost us some runs. And so to pin it all on me from that one thing that took place, that's not something that the ball team would have done. And I never played on a team that would have done that. But here I am in a corporate environment and we're going to do that, you know, in a heartbeat. And so that's the story that I shared with my team that from now on, if we fail because somebody forgot to submit something to finance and there was a big financial impact, well, that was one thing this year of probably 150 things that we could, you know, call out as being, you know, being contributing to the failure. So that was where we started to try to drive this culture in a way that we're a unit. We are one team. We win and lose together. and we need to work well together. We need to like each other. And that's been the goal. So I know, as I said, that's a difficult question to answer, but I hope I was able to shed some light on that.
No, you did. I liked what you said. As a team, you win together and you lose together. And I want to get to in a second how you're able to build that culture. But what do you say to the naysayers out there, the business leaders, the CEOs who are like, oh, culture's overrated? They'll say, well, culture, it's great to have a nice, warm culture. Everybody likes each other. But how does it affect the ROI? What would you say to the naysayers out there who say that culture's overrated?
Yeah, well, I would say that they're in the minority, I think, these days, and you know, also a dinosaur as it relates to leadership. What we've seen in our business is, you know, and the awards that you referenced there, Damon, we won Canada's Most Admired Corporate Culture Award three consecutive times, and that three consecutive times represents about a decade of culture leadership. And what we've seen, that award is only given out is if you can correlate the things that you do to culture, if you can correlate that to high performance. So this award isn't just about, you know, the warm and fuzzies. This award is about, do you do all that stuff to create this great environment, and does it equate to success out in the market? And so we've been able to demonstrate that. For us, the biggest example that I can give, because it was probably one of the toughest periods of my career ever, was the pandemic. I had just taken over the CEO spot when the pandemic hit. So this is one of those things where, you know, I felt I was well prepared to come in as the CEO because, you know, I've been here in these executive roles for a number of years. I had kind of built up this toolbox of how I will lead. And then the pandemic hits and then we all work from home and throw the toolbox away. And then I thought, wow, we're really going to be in a tough situation because I don't know exactly how to manage this business in this environment. And what, you know, some of the decisions were big, right? And how do I make that decision? And, you know, what I realized was because we had a strong culture, the resilience of the team shone through brighter than anything else. And so I don't think we would have got through the first 2 years of the pandemic if we hadn't had the culture that we had. What I saw, actually, Damon, was I saw a team who, because of the culture that we had put in place, and then the going got tough, right? Remember back to those very early days of the pandemic when bodies piled up at hospitals and all that terrible stuff. We were scared. We were scared that, you know, that we would get sick and die. We were scared that family members would get sick and die. We were also, you know, fearful of the fact that, you know, will our company stay healthy? Will we have jobs 6 months from now? And all of that was very, very daunting. And what I saw the team do was, wait a minute, remember, we're in this together. Win or lose, we're in this together. So let's get together and make this a winning situation. And I saw the team work harder than ever to collaborate. I saw people going above and beyond what we expect of them. And it was all because, you know, the way I like to put it is, you know, a lot of companies talk about purpose these days, right? And we were not really sold on the purpose thing until recently. And why that is that I believe that the pandemic created a purpose for us. And the purpose was to get through it unscathed, to get through it both personally, you know, in the personal sense, you know, let's stay healthy. And, you know, the company was facilitating that, spending money, making investments to provide all of the necessary tools and benefits and everything that the team would need to be able to work from home and feel that we've got them covered. And then the team reciprocated by making sure that they worked extra hard to keep the company healthy. And it was, you know, as I reflected back on it only a couple of years later, that's what I concluded. It was because all of a sudden the pandemic created this purpose that we could rally behind. And everybody, you know, felt they had skin in the game on that one.
So that created the purpose during COVID. And not saying we're completely out of it, everything, but now that COVID is pretty much, we're kind of over, does the purpose have to be different? Have you pivoted what the purpose is?
Yeah, well, that's what, you know, now, you know, that's exactly where I went, Damon, is I said, okay, so now maybe COVID's not quite the purpose it used to be. We're not in the same situation we were back in 2020 or 2021. But it definitely showed me the power of purpose. So then it became, and one of the things that we do every year, Damon, is we do it's the Engage survey, and it's an employee engagement survey and basically a cultural assessment. And we had, you know, we just did it again this year. We had a 91% participation rate. That's how much it means to our team. And the data that comes back every year for as many years as we've been doing this is, and this primarily comes from the younger generations, which is, I don't want to work for a company that's only about profit. I want to work for a company that's going to do some good in the world. And that kept becoming a, you know, kind of a glaring gap in our culture. Maybe the only gap, but it was a gap. And, you know, so what we decided to do was that if we create a purpose that we can, you know, have in place going forward, that, you know, beyond the pandemic, would that be, not only would that provide us with that same kind of environment that we had during the beginning of the pandemic, but could we sustain that going forward, where it's going to give us all the benefits, where people are going to feel more fulfilled in the roles that they're playing in the organization? So we're in the process now, Damon, of, you know, we spent the last 6 or 8 months coming up with our purpose statement, which is something that, you know, we took a lot of time coming up with because we wanted it to be concise and you know, have legs where it could last into the future. And now we are building a strategy around that to how can that purpose impact all of the stakeholders that touch our company, everything from our clients and their customers, our internal team members, you know, the federation and the network of companies that my company belongs to, as well as our community, whether that's the communities that we serve in or the global community for that matter. And so for me, this is how we're going to elevate, because Damon, a lot of times with all these awards that we've received, people tell me, Dan, with culture, you have nowhere to go but down. And my response to that is, maybe we just don't all understand on how good a culture can become. And so how we feel that we're going to elevate it to the next level, you know, we have a pretty darn good culture already, but how we're going to elevate it to the next level is, we're going to go beyond corporate values and go beyond some of the other things that have been integral to our culture by putting a purpose in place that we can all rally behind, that will bring us together, and we'll all get this great feeling that we're doing more for the world than just what we do in our business every day.
I think that's great. It isn't just about the leadership creating it. It's getting the buy-in from everybody around, right? Especially the younger generations who are pushing all of us towards this direction. And the consistency and the communication required to maintain and continue to evolve culture.
I say it every day to my team, is that culture is not about Dan. Culture is not about the executive team. We don't push that down on you. Culture is something that is created from everybody. So in the annual survey that we do, that's actually one of the questions, is who owns culture at Experigo? And, you know, the answer is the CEO, the executive team. And I don't remember the exact number now, but it was somewhere in the neighborhood of like 80% of the team clicked the right answer, which was culture is about all of us. Because at the end of the day, it's how each person interacts and treats every other person in the organization. You know, you asked me earlier, people ask me all the time, what's the secret sauce, Dan, to the culture? And I gave you, the best answer I could in this format, but because the answer can be really long, right? But the short answer is this, you know, my mom used to tell me as I was a young kid, treat people the way that you would like to be treated. If we all did that in business, you've got a culture. That's a culture now, right? If we all treat each other the way that we would want to be treated, with respect and fairness and trust and all those great things, then how can you not have a good culture? Imagine if we did that in society across the board, right? I mean, how great would this world be? So this is an old, you know, kind of tale to tell, which is treat people the way that you would like to be treated, because none of us like to be treated badly. The command and control leadership style of, I'll tell you to jump, you just ask how high. Nobody wants to be treated that way. You don't want to be treated. I don't want to be. So why do we feel that we can treat some people that way? So to me, that's the, you know, if I had to simplify it down to one line, that would be it.
I want to bring you back. I know we're coming up on time. I want to bring you back just to dig into how you've gone about creating this culture. But to wrap it up today, I mean, Dan, this has been amazing. Talking about the importance of being persistent, having a work ethic, to making bold decisions, taking risks. And as far as creating a culture, treating people the way that you want to be treated and having a people-first mentality. So, Dan, you're awesome. Where can our audience connect with you at?
You can connect with me on LinkedIn. I've got a profile there. It's LinkedIn / Dan Turner. Pretty simple. And if anybody wants to message me on LinkedIn, feel free to do so.
Thank you, Dan. It's been wonderful having you here. And for our listeners, out there, do me a favor. Pick up your phone, text this episode to your friends and anybody who's involved in either being an entrepreneur, running a business, or creating a great culture. And until next time, everybody, stay curious and keep learning. Have a great day.